Welcome to GoodNix, a podcast about doing good in the world. Together, we dig into the experiences of people who do good in very different ways to understand what inspires them, what frustrates them, and what keeps them going. I'm Annalisa Enrile, a social worker, professor, and human rights activist. Whether you're doing good yourself or just thinking about it, I'm glad you're here. In our last episode, we talked to our GoodNix about what happens when they finish their good work in the world. What do they do after they've made a particular dent in the universe? And who are they after they cross that bridge? In this episode, we unpack the internal struggles, the personal sacrifices, and the external pressures that our GoodNix confront as they do good in the world. What do they have to give up to do this work?
I've ended up in the place that I promised myself I wouldn't end up in, which is complete burnout. Not just burnout, but like annual cycles of burnout that led to the ultimate burnout, which led to me waking up last February with chest pain, unable to get out of bed in the morning, all the symptoms of like depression and burnout.
David founded a nonprofit that organizes against genocides around the world.
I went and I Googled it. I'm like, yep, that's me. And I still had to go through, I was running, like, you know, my organization, I speak in the we, but it's mostly me, right? Like most founders and most nonprofits are really small, trying to struggle, get off the ground. We do global programming. We do crazy big things with hundreds of organizations and thousands of people, but the we is a lot of me. But because I've been working in this field in such close proximity to trauma of not just the Jewish people, but of so many other people that have been experiencing identity-based violence of late and historically, I absorbed a lot of it, and I ended up in a very scary place where I decided I didn't want to be a martyr for this movement. Wouldn't it really be a big disservice to my grandfather, grandparents, my grandfather, the Jewish people, and thinking about, you know, the whole idea of perpetuating the Jewish people and Hitler's goal to annihilate all of us? And if I became a statistic where I either was unwell to the point that I didn't live a full life, or God forbid, in an era in which suicide is on the rise, that I would contemplate or consider such a thing. So it was really important for me to pause. But at that time, when I realized I was in trouble, I had to push through my organization's biggest annual campaign, April, Genocide Awareness Month, 30 days of activism and awareness building and action with a group of 25 students who were in this fellowship program, global fellowship program that I had created. And this was the training ground for them to basically spread their wings and fly and do their thing, all from South Africa to the United States and Zambia and beyond. And I had to keep the face. I had to show up every week and not be the guy who was breaking down. And that also ate away at me. So I had this sort of porcelain exterior, but in within, the fire that motivated my work. And I like this metaphor of a fire within. It's a fire that brings people together, unite, keep us warm. But it's also a fire that if it gets out of control, it can consume others. It can consume me. And it almost did. And so I got through April, and that included a 24-hour virtual global vigil. So 24 hours of hour-by-hour content from Yazidi leaders, Uyghur leaders, Syrians, Cambodians, Rwandans, Bosnians, right? This was the epitome that my organization is called Together We Remember. And I had finally achieved the goal of convening the we, the people who are closest to this pain and who have the potential to turn remembrance into action and inspire. I read a book called Bury the Chains by Adam Hochschild when I was 18 in a leadership development course at Duke. And it talked about the group of folks that gathered in a tavern in the UK and said, what if we ended the British slave trade? And 50 years later, they were successful. This was my tavern moment, but it was precisely at my tavern moment where I completely disintegrated, and a version of that burnout happened. And I realized that I had to take time and space. So since June, July of 2021, I've been taking space. The first 6 months was just to slow down, heal, and restore. And now I'm shifting back into dipping my toe in the water. There's the somatic, the body version of it, where I literally couldn't find a way to get out of bed in the morning. And then the voices in my head are so noisy, so loud, the shoulds, the coulds. Essentially what this boils down to is living in a constant state of past and future, not presence. And it's what I've come to learn is it's in presence that we channel our creativity, that we can receive. If you're spiritual, you can receive whatever's out there meant for you. That's purpose. That's, You know, I have a post-it right here to the right of me that says, life is the 100-foot wave. And it's from Garrett McNamara, who is a big wave surfer. He goes to Nazaré in Portugal. And what he said in the documentary resonated with me exactly with what I've experienced, which is, if he's thinking about the last wave or something else or something his wife said or his kids said to him before he went on that wave, or if he's thinking about what if I fall or what's going to happen if I don't get that sponsorship deal, he's going to fall and he's probably going to die, right? So a lot of us are surfing our own 100-foot wave. And I found myself constant, like I was going at pretty high speeds in this work and my life is on the line as well, whether I show up in places that are more dangerous around the world or in Pittsburgh or Parkland or Baltimore or other communities that have been recently affected by violence where I've done quite a bit of work, it can be consuming. So there's that aspect of it, being stuck in this weird time machine where you don't know, am I in the past? Am I in the future? Can I just be here right now? And it's really only when I meditate and I'm really pushing myself to meditate for 30 to 60 minutes a day that I can slow my nervous system down and let it know, thank you for watching out for me at all those other points in time. I'm not trying to fight it, right? Because it's like this trap where the more you resist, the stronger the resistance gets. And it's a bit of a paradox, but I'm trying to learn to let go and just be and allow the system to work through what it needs to. But in that moment, I didn't have those skills and it was really challenging. And it became more insular. The other thing I want to share about being a founder and building an organization is I felt like I became someone I didn't want to be in that everything was an opportunity for extraction. I had to make the most out of every family relationship, every friend relationship, any connection, professional opportunities. And at my essence, I'm a connector. I am a friend to strangers. I used to be a part of this organization called Tea with Strangers where we would just host gatherings of strangers of five or six people. And it was amazing. And, you know, that part of me felt like it died for a while. And I didn't feel like I was in my power anymore. So it was tough. And then think about, like, you've built this spaceship or this plane that's like being held together by tape and twine and whatever. And you got to just hold it together. And the way that I was educated was you have proof of concept. You show what you can do. You have those closest to the problem endorse your work. You have experts endorse your theories and your strategies. And then the funders will get it. They'll be like, great. So I was like, okay, I know how this works. I know what I need to look like. So I created what I thought I needed to look like. And that's where these aspects, it's not just burnout. It's also something that I've been learning more about called moral injury. And those have like adjacent, but different symptoms in some sense where you feel like you've done the right thing. You've played the game the way it's supposed to be played. And you still don't end up where you're supposed to be. And we're seeing that's part of this big exodus in workplaces where it's like, you know what? You've like literally offended my spirit. And I no longer want to be party to that damaging environment. And so I was thinking about coming onto this podcast. And I'm like, how am I going to do this without just lighting the world on fire with all of my bitterness and resentment? And we've lost some incredible leaders of late from the civil rights movement who really emphasize not becoming bitter. Don't become bitter. And that was a really key principle of Dr. King as well. And I have struggled with that, not becoming bitter and really targeting that bitterness at my own people. Because I feel like I went out on a limb. I went to all the Holocaust education stuff. I went to the concentration camps. I decided to dedicate my life to it. I think I'm doing it in the right way with mistakes that we're learning. And at this point, do I believe in everything that we were doing? Hell yes. Do I feel fulfilled in so many ways? Hell yes. But I got married, not just once, but twice to the same woman, because once was on Zoom and once was in person during this whole pandemic. And I said in my vows, my purpose in this world is not to save the world. It is to experience it with you, right? To my wife. And that was sort of the shift that I've made. And I'd love to still live with purpose, and I probably will. But I can't be a martyr. And there's like this weird hope in me that someone will listen to this podcast or whatever. And they're like, you know what? This guy knows something. Maybe we should give him a shot. And so I'm clinging on hope to like that sort of thing. But maybe I need to just start the grieving process and go through that very difficult closure phase with this organization, despite me still believing and having so many people out in the world, thousands of people who I've worked with, who are like, we need this, David. Can you help us? Not just you, David, but like this community that we built. And I don't know. I'm struggling right now as we speak with it. And I'm just trying to, similar to that meditation and letting it be, I'm trying to let it be. But it's tough because I really want to get to those phases of belonging again. I want to belong to like community. I want to be a part of the Jewish people, but not on the terms of victimhood, on the terms of thriving and beautiful spirituality. But that's not what I inherited, at least not the, what the mainstream institution like invested in me or made me give me opportunity to experience. And then I want to become something awesome. I want to resolve as much of this trauma, because whenever we don't resolve in our generation, it just gets passed on to the next generation. So the stakes are quite high. And my heart of hearts, I'm not going to give up on this sort of stuff, but I may have to find a new way.
David's self-reflection is a powerful reminder of the sacrifices we make when doing good. We found that almost all our goodniks share a value that motivates them to keep going, a heavy sense of obligation to their work and to their community. Deborah is a social worker, a psychotherapist, and the founder of community programs that serve women and youth in Los Angeles.
There was many sacrifices. I could have went into a different field and make a lot of money. Maybe I could have become an attorney and still impact our communities and do good work and made more money than I make now. But I had a passion into pulling up my sleeves and getting down and dirty, like they say, doing the work right there and then with the client, just really wanting to impact that one-on-one. My undergrad is not in social work. My undergrad is in psychology. So, you know, I started there. And so I knew that I wanted to make a big difference by having this particular moment with people when they're struggling and hearing their story and finding ways where I could support the next steps for them to move forward in their lives. So that's how that started. And then my knowledge started growing and I started seeing that, wow, I can make more impact if I go into social work. I can still do the clinical work that I'm doing now and continue to see the bigger picture. How does everything impact, you know, a person or situations? But the passion was to do tikkun olam in a way where, or correcting the world one action at a time, in a way where I was there. I was walking with my clients. I was walking with my community. I was there advocating and saying, having a bigger, I want to say a say more directly because I'm there with everyone, you know. So that's basically what really made a difference of me wanting to be in social work rather than other careers that could have made me more money.
Tanara is a disruptor who battles inequity wherever she finds it.
A couple years ago, I was doing a lot of examining of privilege, especially in the spaces that I work in. As somebody who has spent the last, we'll call it 10 years, but probably more of my career in the product and service innovation side, I do feel a deep sense of obligation from a few places. One, from the fact that I get access to these spaces where things are made for people on their behalf. Right. So I have a sense of this obligation to bring equity to that and to use my privilege for good in spaces, frankly, as a Black woman, but also as a Black woman who frankly has skin privilege. Right. I'm a light skinned Black woman because I'm biracial. So I have skin privilege and I can acknowledge that. And so I carry that weight in terms of my obligation to continue to illuminate the struggles of all people of color, but especially Black women. Like, it's a big one for me. Black and brown women need to be represented, and those of us who can traverse those spaces more easily need to be willing to stand at the front of that conversation because we're more easily accepted into spaces that other people aren't. So obligation is huge, but not obligation is like an albatross, right? For me, it's fuel. Some people, I think, and frankly, we're all really tired right now, right? We've had the last few years of there's so many things that are screwed up. Trying to figure out where to focus can make that obligation feel like the heaviest weight you can carry. So part of that boldness and standing out on that limb for me is prioritization. I can't care about everything all at the same time, and I can't do everything all at the same time as much as I'd want to. So it's a little less heavy and a little less lonely if I can be really clear about the things I care about and step in front of them really intentionally.
Jesse is an expert in building movements, organizing thousands or sometimes millions of people to make change.
Application is like such an interesting concept because I would say on one hand, there is like something in my DNA almost where if I know that there is injustice, I think on like a very personal level, I feel obligated to be a part of fighting that injustice. Like, where does that come from? Is that at like a DNA molecular level? But I actually think as I have grown older and I've had more and more political fights and movement fights, the obligation has taken on a really different form for me, which is, and it's kind of an uncomfortable thing to say because I'm not trying to pat my own back, but like, I think I'm pretty good at this stuff. Like, I think I have an understanding of what it takes to build power. And I think fundamental to movement building is really understanding power and knowing what it takes to build it and leverage it in the right way. And so at this point in my life, the obligation comes from the fact, like, how can I be on the sidelines if I actually have something to offer this fight that could help us win? And one of the places that probably shines brightest is when it comes to electoral organizing, like elections in general. Elections are so brutal. And I can't even tell you the number of times I've said, that's it. Like, no more. This is my last election cycle. I will not be involved in the next election cycle. Except because I'm a movement person, I have to care about elections because movements are about building power. Power gets exercised in electoral ways. And, you know, after 2020, I'm like, I can't do this again. And of course, what? It's February 2022. And I'm like in so deep thinking about 2022. I convince myself once again, it's the most important moment. So, yeah, at this point, the obligation is a lot about like, I have the battle wounds of being a movement builder and an organizer, and I have the strategic insights. And perhaps most importantly, like, I've made so many mistakes. And that makes you really valuable in these moments because you've learned from those mistakes.
Jennifer is a neonatal ICU nurse where she spends her days caring for critically ill babies.
You know, it's not all like soft lighting and miracles when I go into work. There are days that I go in that I don't want to be there. In the NICU, when we have a baby, one of the hardest parts of their journey is figuring out how to eat and grow. And it's something we take for granted with normal, healthy newborn babies. But with premature babies or babies that are born sick, the process of learning how to eat can be very lengthy. And so we have this sort of category of patients that we call feeder growers, where all they're doing is trying to figure out how to eat. And so every 3 hours, I have to practice feeding them with a bottle. And whatever they don't take with the bottle, I have to put through their feeding tube. It's somewhat monotonous. And so there are those days that I get up and I go into work, and it's an obligation and it's a duty. But same as any other practice that we do that we love, whether it is a spiritual practice of attending a service or a physical practice of working out, at one point in my life, and it's been a minute since I've had it, but at one point in my life, I had a very intense yoga practice where I got up every morning and I did 2 hours of yoga before I started my day. And there were some days that it felt like an obligation just to get to that mat. But at the same time, there were days that getting there and getting through it was the gift. And I think that is the gift. That is the journey, is that there are sometimes that it's not fun. And it allows me to have those days that feel miraculous and that I feel honored to be a part of. So some days it's an obligation, but as a calling, I don't feel it is.
It is not an easy choice, the one to do good and change the world, but it is one that all of our Goodniks made with purpose and with intention, even when it costs them a great deal personally and professionally. Can a better world be worth the sacrifices they make? Social scientists have different names for this type of sacrifice: altruism, utilitarianism, benevolence. And actually, our brains are wired for empathy, cooperation, generosity, and connection. The real danger is when sacrifice is so great that it becomes harmful. That is why it's important to take a break or a breath or some time to ourselves. Audre Lorde called rest an act of political warfare. Self-care is important, not just for yourself, but for the communities you are part of. So the next time you feel you need a moment, take it. The world needs you. In our next episode, we talk to our Goodniks about who keeps them going. We hear stories about the people who light their way and give them strength. Thank you for being part of Goodniks. Goodniks was created and executive produced by Jeff Leitner, produced by Amanda Roscoe Mayo, with original music by Adam Ohlendorf, and I'm your host, Annalisa Enrile. Goodniks is supported by the Jim Joseph Foundation and inspired by every one of you who is doing good in the world. To learn more about Goodniks, visit goodniks.org. That's GoodNiks.org. Or follow us on Twitter at @TheGoodniks or on Instagram at @the_Goodniks.